Hello to all our listeners and welcome back to The Green Print. You're here again with Leighton Walker, and it's an architectural episode this time round. And we're talking to Mike Cocking of OCM, one third of OCM, so the other two being Jeff Ogilvy and Ashley Mead. So I sat down with Mike a couple of weeks ago, and we talked through many things, a little bit about his journey, but probably a little bit more around his philosophy on architecture. But we deep dive into a couple of particular projects that are either just completed or on the go still at the moment. One of those is the Fall Line in Georgia, a particularly unique project in that it features two golf courses, but of quite differing styles, and styles that have been effectively pinched from other parts of the world, in particular the Melbourne Sandbelt, one of the courses, and the other one's more modelled on or based on sort of the Surrey Heathland, if you like. So quite unique in that sense. The project is getting rave reviews. It's quite an exclusive club, so there's probably not a lot of people that are actually going to see them. But if you do manage to get some vision, we'll put some in any social media that we put out. It looks fantastic. We also touch on another project that OCM are completing at the moment. It's called Tepi Tonka in Minnesota. A nice piece of land that they've got to work with there. And again, a really nice project. And look, OCM have been doing some really, really good work over the last few years. You might have seen their redesign or redevelopment of Medina Number 3, you know, quite a famous golf course. And that looks like it's come out an absolute treat. And they've also touched on other golf courses like Shady Oaks in Texas, and also Lonsdale Links down in Australia. I know they've just won another project at Grange West in Adelaide, part of the composite course where they play the LIV golf event down there. So that'll be another great project for them as well as Huntingdale in Melbourne too. So lots of good things going on for OCM. Really good conversation with Mike. Hope you enjoy that. We'll roll over to that now, but that'll be just after a word from our loyal partner in Toro. And we'll catch you all back here on the next episode. The Green Print is proud to partner with Toro. When selecting golf course maintenance equipment, reliability is essential. That's why Toro products are the choices of golf courses the world over. They know they can count on Toro mowers, utility vehicles, and more to work. They also know they can rely on Toro for the innovations and engineering that blend high productivity with a beautiful course appearance. It's going to be our aim here on The Green Print to talk to many users of this equipment around the world and explore some of those innovations and engineering. You'll have heard our last episode with Andy Johnston at Sentosa in Singapore. So for products that get the job done, visit toro.com/golf. You in Melbourne?
I am.
Yeah. Okay. Where's home for you in Melbourne?
Kind of round the corner from Royal Melbourne.
Okay. Nice.
Beaumaris. That's probably... Yep. Probably a kilometre, I would say, from Royal Melbourne.
Okay, yeah.
Nice. But I'm home for a nice, yeah, this is the longest stint I've been at home since COVID, I would say.
Right, okay, because so you've done a lot of time in the States, haven't you?
Yeah, a lot of back and forth in the States, yeah. So I think I'm home, in total this trip I'll be home about 7 weeks, so yeah, which is great.
Okay. And what's, you might want to be a bit humble about this, perhaps. You were a good player, weren't you? what sort of level did you play, and what sort of era were you coming through the amateur ranks? When was that?
So I was playing my best golf in sort of 2000, 2001, 2002, okay. Around there.
Yeah.
So I was a good amateur. I won the state amateur.
Okay.
I came fifth in the Australian Masters when that was still a big thing.
Yeah. Were you leading after the first round or something?
Yeah, I was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Me and Peter Fowler were 7 under after the first round.
Illustrious company. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Did you figure in any Aussie amateurs?
Yeah, kind of always in the mix, but not. Yep. I didn't ever make it to any of the finals. But I came second in the Riversdale Cup, played the British amateur and Scottish stroke play. And I did sort of three, for whatever reason. Well, at the time, there was this big deal about you couldn't get a funded trip to the US or it was a breach of amateur status.
That's right.
Whereas for whatever reason, you could to the UK. So Australians had more of a, for whatever reason, we had this sort of affinity with the Brits. I guess maybe it's part of our history. But
colonial thing.
Yeah, so I did about 4 years probably where I'd go over and play the St Andrews Links Trophy and the British Amateur, and it was a really nice run. The Brabazon, was
Amazing
about a
stuff, isn't it?
6 week. Yeah, it was really good, and we got to play great golf courses. So yeah, I did that for a while. I turned professional briefly, maybe for 2 years. I think I was a professional, but I kind of always I, was, I sort of wore two hats there for a while. I just got a start in golf course design. I loved it, and I was part of the Institute of Sport here, which was kind of like our college program. I always found like I'd be at golf for the day with them, and it was all geared around turning professional and your career and everything. And I'd be wearing that hat, and then in the afternoon I'd go and because I was working sort of casually in golf course design at the time, and sort of then I'd put that hat on. I'd be like, I just want to do this for a career. So I was sort of
Did
in
the bug
between.
bite? Does the bug bite a little bit with the design side? I guess is there a
It
bit of that?
does, yeah. If,
And it's
when
a
you see so many people aren't ambivalent towards golf course design, I think they're either absolutely madly passionate about it and read everything and talk about it, or they're not interested in it, but there's no in between.
And I guess as well, like you go into golf because you love playing golf, don't you? As a kid, like all you want to do is play golf, don't you? But probably when you get into that professional ranks, it becomes a bit more of a grind, doesn't it? And it's not so much for the love, it's about making a living and all that sort of thing. But I guess when you go off into the design side, it's like, no, I'm doing this because I really want to. I choose to. It lights a fire in me, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot of my friends and contemporaries when I was playing. They kind of fell out of love with the game, which is a real pity because they got in, they obviously loved it. Golf ends up being a job, and then, you associate, unfortunately, all the heartache and missing cuts and all the rest of it. They end up just wanting nothing to do with it. So they get to mid to late 20s. And I was really lucky that I made the switch before that ever happened. I love the game as much as I did then. I don't have as much time to play, but I still love it. So I'm
You just love it in a different
thankful
way,
for that.
don't you? I think, I mean, I played amateur golf up until 22 or something and thought, no, I think I might need to go and get a job that's going to actually pay me some money going forward. And,
Yeah.
absolutely loved my amateur golf and everything that goes with that. But then it's like, and probably from 22 to 25, I had a horrible period where you're almost expecting you can do what you used to do, but
Yeah.
you're not putting in the work or the practice or whatever. And then I don't know, I hit like 26 and it's like a light bulb goes off, doesn't it? That I need to actually enjoy this, play for fun, enjoy it. There's a
Yeah.
social element to this. If you play good golf, great. If you don't, not the end of the world, is it?
That's right. But I kind of loved the idea too that as a designer, you were sort of the puppet master. It's like you were above just playing. It's like you were actually setting the field, and watching all those.
Watching
The
others
guys that you used
struggle.
to play with, yeah, seeing how you could mess with them, and I just loved that idea. So it
What's
wasn't a
that?
difficult shift in that sense.
And you're working at Huntingdale now, is that right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So that
Yep.
must be nice after the old Aussie masters.
Yeah.
In fact, that's
Yep.
my Huntingdale's my oh, this is I always say it's my almost claim to fame that I missed out on the 32 of the Aussie Amateur in a 20-man playoff.
Oh,
So even
wow.
my finest moment in golf didn't actually amount to success. There we go.
What year was that, Bladen?
95, I reckon. I reckon Matt Goggin might have won it that year.
Oh,
Pretty
yeah. Yep.
sure.
Yep.
Yeah, it was around Huntingdale and Metro, so literally over the
Yeah.
fence. It was great fun. But yes, still never made it. So what's that like? That must be cool working at Huntingdale because it's a pretty iconic course, isn't it? With the Masters having been there for so long.
Yeah, it's funny because there was a couple of Brits that worked at the club, and I was chatting to them. They're friends, and they were saying growing up in England, the two courses in Australia that were the most famous to them anyway was Royal Melbourne and Huntingdale because of the Masters. And we probably didn't appreciate that here in Australia because there was sort of Kingston Heath and and Victoria and Metro and the others. But yeah, it's been great. I mean, it's a bit of an outlier from the rest of the Sandbelt because Mackenzie and Russell had such a heavy influence on and the Morecambes on so much of the Sandbelt, but they didn't really, none of them worked at Huntingdale, so it was always kind of in a slightly different style to the others. And we've probably a lot of the work's been probably it's probably aligning a little closer, I guess, to the more famous kind of Sandbelt courses. Yeah.
Smaller site as well, isn't it?
Small, but kind of
Enough
Kingston
to
Heath
work with.
small.
Yeah,
Yeah.
true.
Yeah. I mean, Kingston Heath's pretty small too. It's like 125 acres, and Huntingdale's about 120. So a lot of it's been about opening it up to make it feel a bit bigger. That's been a key part of it, I would say.
And growing up on the Melbourne Sand Belt, it can't get any better than that. I mean, I'm Adelaide boy. We did all right for
Yeah.
golf, but obviously a lot smaller in scale. The city's a lot smaller, so the golfing offers a lot smaller. But growing up in Melbourne, I mean, you just everything's there on a plate for you, isn't it? If you can't learn from that, you probably never will you?
No, it was good. Yeah. And look, I mean, I grew up playing public golf courses. So the Sandbelt, even for me growing up in Melbourne, was always three steps above where I was playing. But then as you get better and you get more opportunities to meet people and play the courses, it is amazing. And you sort of, I don't think you realize how special they are until you go elsewhere, really. Travel more and realize, oh, wow, they're an incredible set of golf courses.
And did you get hunted by one of the top clubs when you got to a certain level?
Not really. So another nice sort of tie back, I guess, is I joined Peninsula. It was then Peninsula Country Golf Club when I was 15. So I grew up on a public course, and then I went from a public course to sort of a public private course on the peninsula. And I was there for 3 or 4 years, and I sort of played well there. And then yeah, but we really had to reach out to Peninsula. It's not like they came knocking, and then I sort of played with a couple of members, and they could see that I was a decent player, and they fast tracked me in to play pennant and things like that. So then you go forward 20 years, and when we were asked to come back and redesign Peninsula, or by then it was called Peninsula Kingswood, that was a really
That
nice.
must
It
be
was
cool.
more than just a job, because it was going back to where you kind of still knew a lot of members and kind of knew every square inch of the property, and so that's been a great experience.
I actually did that managing because I managed clubs away from doing this,
All
and
right. Okay.
grew up in Adelaide, a little nine holer, and then went off
Yep.
to Glenelg Golf Club, one of the bigger clubs in Adelaide,
Yeah, yeah,
and
yep.
then actually came back. And managed the little nine holer that I grew up. So I get that feeling.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it? Because you
It
got
is.
such great childhood memories and all the stuff that goes with that. And then to go back there
Oh,
and
totally.
be plying your trade there, it's an interesting feeling.
No, I was going to say, I mean, it can have its downsides too, because obviously,
Too much
if something's
familiarity
not going
sometimes.
well, or if something's a bit, controversial, they'll spot you in a car park. You'll never have any quiet time on the putting green ever again. But no, it's for the most part, it's all very positive. It's all good.
absolutely. And just on the Sandbelt still. So I mean, look, I don't know. Maybe I'm being a bit unfair here and missing some good people, but it seems that so many of the good architects that have come out of Australia or are still coming out of Australia tend to be from that area, don't they? Do you reckon it's a coincidence, or do you reckon it's that pure inspiration of growing up on there? You think of yourselves, Jeff. Mike Clayton and Peter Thompson back in the day, Tim Lobb, I spoke to on the show a little while
Yeah,
ago, and
Tim.
just there's
Yeah.
just a really good pedigree of Aussie architects that have come via the Melbourne Sand Belt.
It's good. It's a good point. I don't know the answer. I mean, I guess there's a high density of courses in the Melbourne Sydney area, so there's probably more
True.
opportunities, I would say. Whereas, like somewhere like Perth, there's not that many courses, so you're sort of. So maybe some of it is the sand belt, but maybe it's also just the result of the bulk of golf courses in Australia are kind of skewed down in that area. So as you're coming through, yeah, there's a bit of a chance to kind of climb the ladder.
A bit of a numbers game, you reckon?
Maybe, maybe. I'd never thought about it, but it's the best I've got for now.
Neither had
Yeah.
I until about an hour ago, but just as I was, it just becomes quite evident. But right, so who are OCM, right? We probably shouldn't assume that everyone out there knows who OCM are, so give us the
No,
little
so
backstory.
it's an acronym. So Jeff Ogilvie, myself, and Ashley Mead. So we, Ashley and I, started working together in 2000. So we've been design partners, sort of, or working together for 25 years. So we both actually got an opportunity. Our first start was with Mike Clayton and his firm in 2000. So I had done an engineering degree and had a golfing background. Ashley was an assistant superintendent at a sort of a sandbelt club.
So he's come out
Yep,
of
so
that
he sort of
route.
had more of a He had more of a turf background, but he played golf as a kid and he was a decent player as a
Sure.
kid. And we started with them, and kind of, and that was a real success for kind of probably 9 years, I think, and did a lot of work around Australia. And then that company sort of wound up and we started the new firm, which was then OCCM because Mike
That's
was still
right.
with it. And so it was the four of us then, and then a few years ago, Mike, left and is now with the CDP guys. Yeah, and the three of us, but to be honest, the company's more than just the three of us. We have 5 full-time shapers, we have a project manager. So it's, and I think the key to our success or the quality of our work is very much a result of that kind of team dynamic. Yeah, more than just one opinion. So usually when we do, once we get into construction, typically either Ashley or I'll take more of a leading role. We might be sort of more 70% of the time. We'll all tend to get involved with kind of coming up with concept, but someone will generally take the lead and then the others will sort of pop in and out and kind of kick around different ideas and edit work. And so it ends up being, a bit of a collaborative effort, I would say.
And then of more recent times, there's been a bit of a shift outside of Australia and expanding into a very, very large market in the US. How's that transition been?
Oh, it's been great. I mean, it's just sort of naturally happened, though. We didn't set out to kind of conquer America or anything like that. We'd looked at a lot of projects in Asia, I would say, for a 5 or 6 year period. Ashley and I have been to Thailand and Vietnam and China, Cambodia, Singapore, Malaysia, all sorts. But interestingly, most of the clients over there, like I would say, and it's not meant to sound disrespectful, but it's a fairly unsophisticated golfing market, I would say, Asia, where they didn't necessarily know what was a great course and what was not a great course. That was probably more condition based, or it was a name that they wanted. And so typically we found they either wanted Greg Norman or Nick Faldo or Jack Nicklaus, or they wanted to pay the least amount possible. And we were neither. We were kind of in between. And so it's sort of, it was never, even though we looked at a lot of jobs and there were a lot that we were really interested in, it just never quite was a great fit.
And a
And
lot more of
then,
that resort style, I guess, as well. A lot of the
yeah,
sort of
probably less of the kind of that modern destination course, which is very focused on pure golf, not so much of that. Little bit in Vietnam, maybe, but not really, not much. But still good land, lots of good land. I mean, that strip along
Especially
the east coast
Vietnam,
of Vietnam, oh yeah, it's like 200 miles long and sand dunes everywhere. So there's definitely the land to build great golf. It's just probably hasn't been their motivation. It has been more geared around results. So then we looked at a project through a friend, a tour pro, Harrison Frazier, actually, who used to be on the PGA Tour.
Good player.
It was through him we heard about this project in Dallas, South Dallas, which is Trinity Forest, which is the course they did there. And we looked at that in about 2015 and or 2014. And I flew over, I met Jeff there, we spent some time on site, met the client, and we came up with a pitch, spent a lot of time on it, I did a routing, and the client loved it, really loved it. And then right at the last minute, Coren Crenshaw said, actually, we might take a look at that. And Ben, being from Texas, it was all
The stars
fine.
are
It
in
all made sense.
alignment.
And the client said he loved our routing. He really did. And we stayed in touch. And then through a friend, I heard that Shady Oaks were going to be doing a redesign. And I reached out to Harrison Frazier to see if he knew anything about it, because he was from the DFW kind of area. And he was standing next to Bill Corr in a bunker at Trinity Forest. And Bill said, well, I know Mike Wright, the pro at Shady Oaks. I'll give him a call. He called him and suggested that they look at us. And we made, and then they reached out and we were shortlisted. Again, flew over, spent 2 or 3 days on the course, came up with a pitch and they picked us. And that was the start of it. So wasn't it just kind of the stars aligned, really?
Accidental nature to it, but obviously something that you're very open to at the same time,
Yeah, and look, and America is a great fit for us. And We finished that job. We did a short course initially, but then we actually did the course construction just in the lead up to COVID. And in fact, I was on the last green we were building, the very last green, 18. We were halfway through it, and I got an email from the Australian government to say, if you don't leave now, you'll never come home. You know, all the threats. You know, leave now.
Had
So
to
we
be
did.
quarantined for 2 weeks or something, wasn't it? Remember when
Yeah,
that
I
went?
did go.
Oh,
Yeah,
yeah.
I quarantined at home. I remember that trip. I had
Did
to
you?
stay in my bedroom for 2 weeks. You know, the police were going to come around and check and all this stuff, you know.
Amazing stuff, isn't it?
Oh, I know, it's hard to think back. And then but interestingly, about the same time that I was got the email to be called home, got an email from Medina saying, oh, would you be interested in having a look at our project? We're thinking about doing a renovation. So then I was sent home. So that was really the defining moment for us, I would say. We'd just done Shady Oaks, and it was ultimately, when it opened, it was really well received, and it's been, you know, the work's really well liked. And that Medina, so we ended up coming up with a pitch. I had a friend in Chicago who is a good photographer, who I was able to get out on course and take photos from different areas. But Ashley and I hadn't seen the course at this stage. They had an amazing historical back catalogue of plans and topos and photos and all this stuff. And we were able to spend 2 or 3 months putting together a pitch, even though we were in Australia, to pitch for the work. And we ended up getting the job. So, and that was it. And then Ashley and I, after a year, we did a lot of concept work from here, but we knew we had to get there. And we managed to get permission from the Australian government. And 2 weeks before leaving, I had a call from a client's rep who wanted to know if we were interested in having a look at a site in Georgia. Said, yeah, absolutely. So it initially started out as this trip just to go to Medina. We ended up staying for 6 or 8 weeks, and we were 3 weeks at Medina. We looked at this site in Georgia, which became the fall line, and then we looked at three or four other projects. So that trip, it was such a big effort to get there, and then we did the 2 weeks in
Certainly paid off.
hotel quarantine and all the rest of it. To be honest, it was the sliding doors moment, I guess, and that really set the path forward in America.
But I guess without that first job as well, that move, Jay Oaks, that happening. And bang it, that sort of opened the original door, didn't it? And then a bigger door has opened now. And okay, so let's get on to Fall Line. So which having I looked at this a little while ago, I hadn't fully appreciated this, but the Fall Line is actually a geological feature within quite a big part of the Eastern Seaboard, isn't it? But it sort of ends
Is.
in Georgia, I believe, and so I guess the name is derived from there, but this is actually a fall line where it used to be the edge of where the ocean was, I believe, wasn't it? So you get
That's
this sort of
right.
geological shift in the land, and I guess the golf course that you've built is right upon that or right next to that, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It goes from, I was, it was, they originally told me it was from Columbus in Georgia, but not the Ohio one, through to Augusta. So it's about 200 miles of sand. But then I've since been told that it's kind of the same geological formation that goes up into South Carolina and North Carolina, and it's almost part, you know, Pinehurst is almost part of the same thing. But certainly the area where we are in Georgia, Ahoopee is on the same kind of geological formation as well. So yeah, it is. That's where the name's derived from. It had a few different names. I remember the working titles early on was, you know, there was Sand Mountain, and there was
Sand
another one as
Mountain
well. But
doesn't
yeah,
quite make
they
sense. That's
no, I
it's an
know.
oxymoron, isn't it?
They ended up with the fall line though, which I think is actually worked really well. It's a cool logo and a good name.
I like it. And so what's the what was the original genesis of that golf course, and who's behind it, and how did it come about?
Yeah, a group, essentially a group of friends that started a big finance company that sort of is New York and LA. Matt Ken Golfers. Quite, it's unique, really, that like these guys, particularly two of them, essentially started this huge firm, and but they're all just like best friends. It's like when you see them, it's like they're just all catching up from college days. They, to use their words, they kind of said, "Look, we've worked really hard for 30 years or 35 years, and we're kind of at a point where we'd like to have some fun.
A little project and yeah.
And they one of them was a member of Hoopy, I think, and they're all golf guys. They're all members of nice clubs. And through a contact, through this sort of owner's rep, he had found this land sort of 10 or 15 years prior, or he certainly the a number of different sites. And we ended up on that trip, we looked at three different sites. But for a number of reasons, we felt the site we chose was, or we helped choose, was probably the best of all of them. The undulations were just a bit more consistent. The owner's rep really loved it because it had long views off the property, which is kind of rare for Georgia. Some really nice contour, kind of broad contour, 40, 50 feet, a couple of big dunes sort of through it. Pine trees, longleaf pines, and kind of this low heathlandy sort of vegetation, which reminded us a bit of London, a little bit of the sand belt. There's a photo, I remember there's this great photo of when Colt was building Swinley. It's a black and white photo, and they're like blowing up, tree stumps and stuff like that with dynamite. But there's these sort of copses of pine trees and these big long grades and things. And they part of the course looked exactly like that. You had no idea you're in Georgia. Like it could have been in southwest London. Or and if you could switch out the pine trees for eucalypts, you would have sworn you were somewhere down around Melbourne.
So it's almost
So
sitting in between those two things, yeah.
it was, yeah. And it was a big property. It was 1,500 acres. And it started out as an 18-hole course. So we saw it in July 2021, and we ended up we put together quite an extensive pitch, and we ended up routing a few holes and really, really coming up with different concepts and what it was going to look like and what it was going to feel like. And we ended up winning the job around Christmas time, we'll say, that year. So then we started on the routing and the tree removal early in 2022. And it was going to be 18 holes. And then it's sort of as we, it was an interesting property in that you had this western kind of ridge and an eastern ridge and a central clubhouse. And we kind of selected where the clubhouse should go. There was a big pond there. The problem with putting the clubhouse in the western end or the eastern end was trying to get golf from one end of the property to the other was it was too far. And the problem was to explore all those regions, you couldn't really do it in 18 holes. So we ended up, it's whilst it started as 18, we ended up pitching the idea of 27. And we had this really interesting concept, which we'll hopefully use somewhere else one day. But the idea was that there was a Western nine, a Central nine, and an Eastern nine. And the Central nine had some alternate tees and things. So you could sort of
So it
play the
could be
Central
played as
nine.
nine. Yeah.
Correct. You could play it as 36, but you're only building 27. But there was just so much land. They were keen to have more golf. And we ended up, we held firm on, we love this alternate concept. And we ended up having 35 holes for a while,
Okay.
where the first hole was shared between the two courses. I loved this idea that you played the first, that was an alternate tee. So it was a left tee and a right tee, and it was a central fairway, and you got down to the end of the green. I love this idea that it was like, well, you either go left or you go right. Almost like there's a,
That took you
you
off out
could
onto that golf
imagine,
course.
yeah, you could imagine spinning a wheel or something, or maybe it's just up to you and
Choose your
you,
own adventure or
yeah, choose your own
something.
adventure. That's right. And we did stay with that for a while. We were building golf holes, and it was 35. We were like 6 holes deep. Trees, we had done tree clearing. And then they were like, no, we really want 36. We want a traditional 36. And we were just fortunate because we were so far into the construction. We were really fortunate. We ended up coming up with a slight reroute, and we found another couple of holes, so we were able to do it. But we were kind of lucky because you could have easily boxed yourself in and got to the point where it's like, oh, I don't know how we. It's not just as easy as just finding a hole.
And it's got to tie into
No,
the routing then
not when
and
you. Not when it's a new first hole, because you've got to find ground going away from the clubhouse, So we're lucky. So then it became 36. Then the discussion really was around sort of stylistically. And we talked about, well, you could have 36 similar holes like Royal Melbourne or Wingfoot or, even, Sunningdale, I guess, to some extent. Maybe there's a composite course. That could be an idea. And we sort of had that as a bit of an option. But then we talked about the idea of maybe two different styles, two different offerings. And there was part of the course that did feel more like those old black and whites of Sunningdale and Swinley. And there were other parts that did feel a bit more sandbelty, bigger scale, kind of a cross between Pine Valley and the Sandbelt.
Okay. A
And so we
little bit more
pitched in the
open,
end,
perhaps, or
a little bit more open, big broad sort of contours. The Heathland, I guess, course was probably a little bit more intimate. And the way the routing worked, it kind of lent itself to a shorter course. So it's kind of 6,600 yards, six par threes, whereas the West course is much bigger, broader, bigger scale, also longer.
That's always
And
how I tend to think about, now having spent enough time in Australia, obviously growing up there, but also over here in the UK now, that's that definite distinct difference for me is that when I think of Aussie courses, it's that more expansive, open. But then when you come to a Sunningdale or a Berkshire or a Swinley Forest or something, it's that real, I think you used the word intimate there, didn't you? That's probably the best word, isn't it? It's that got that cozy feel. There's, enough sort of woodland tree areas going on, and it's just a little bit tighter, and
when they're a bit, I mean, not that the Sandbelt courses are long, but a lot of the Heathland courses feel like they've been trapped in time where they are, they're just not that long. I mean, somewhere like Swinley, and that's one of our favorite courses, it's barely 6,000 yards.
Yeah,
There's a lot of
played
sort of
West
half
Hill
par fours.
yesterday, par 69, just brilliant, but a bit a very tight site. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
So we actually we'd kind of built a bit of the west and a bit of the east, and then the irrigation kind of dictated we try and finish the east. But we flew over to England. I mean, Ashley had seen it as well, and I'd been there quite a few times to London. But we really wanted to. We don't like the idea of a token effort of an homage to something. Like it's like you're either in or you're out. So we went back for 10 days. Took our shaper as well, took the superintendent, and really did a deep dive again on some of the Heathland courses. And I don't think we would have built the course quite as we did if we hadn't have done that. And so, the greens are fairly simple. They're kind of a lot of them are at grade, a bit like you'd see at Walton Heath, bunkering style, very much inspired by, I would say, the black and whites when the edges were a little bit more irregular, like some of the old pitches in St. George's Hill. And so, yeah, they're more in that sort of rolled in. And a lot of this heathland sort of, we worked with an ecologist to come up with a seed blend that used the site indigenous grasses and plants, but we were deliberately trying, even down to the color, we were trying to get something that could almost mimic heather. We found a couple on site that are actually purple flowers, and there's a period in the year where they look incredible. But
Will heather not go in that? Is it climate or soil dictated or?
well, yeah, and it's kind of it's you're kind of introducing a weed, and we it didn't sit comfortably with us. So and it is very hot down there too, so it'd be borderline of it surviving. But we found these other couple of plants that are really similar. So we kind of wanted to go all in on that. It's a different grass. It's a zoysia because the zoysia looks a little bit like fescue, has a very fine blade, and when it's allowed to grow a little longer, it looks very similar to kind of a cool season grass. So, square tees, kind of a lot of the heathland sort of elements. And then then we went to the west. It's kind of playing to our strength. I mean, we've done a lot of work around the Melbourne area on the Sandbelt courses, and that was, it was great to be able to build Sandbelt in the US, even down to, for years, a lot of, architects and superintendents have looked at the Melbourne bunkers and said, oh, the only place you can do this is in Melbourne. And we're like, well, that's not true. We've done them elsewhere, but still, yeah, fair enough. So then when we went there, we're like, we want to go putting surfaces right to the edge of the bunkers. We want to make this authentic. And so the superintendent was keen as well, and we managed to do it. So it's not bent grass, it's a Bermuda, but runs all the way to the edge of the bunkers, and very very much sandbelt style bunkering, and a lot of the sandbelt style features.
And what about like playability wise? Have you been able to replicate some of the firmness and that side of things that you? It's not just the look; it's the playability that's replicated as well.
Yeah, we'd looked at a lot of different Bermuda grasses over there, and we'd always, people would talk about the characteristics of some of these Bermudas that, and they made it sound like it was similar to the couch grass we have here around the Sandbelt. But you'd look at it and it never was. It was always longer and a bit more leggy. It never had that real firmness. And where you, as a good player, that feeling that you can compress the ball against the turf because it's so tight. And then we're actually pitching on a job at Shoal Creek, and there's an Australian superintendent there, who became good friends with. And he had a new type of Bermuda in his green surrounds called Tiff Grand, which is cut at about like 7 mil. Super tight. So it's almost like in between a bent grass, in between a green and a fairway. Really tight. And we thought, well, this is the nearest thing we've ever seen to Santa Ana on the sand belt. And again, we sort of broached it with the superintendent and got his buy-in, and he was happy to go with it. And so it actually, the West Course plays firm and fast. Run. You actually want to land the ball short. Anytime it's downwind, you're looking 10 or 15 yards short of the green as to what, okay, what's in the, where do I need to land it? And you're worried about the flight of the ball and the spin and all those things that kind of come into play playing around Melbourne. So, which is nice.
It's amazing how they've improved the species of those grasses in Australia as well. Even over the last sort of 20, 30 years since I've, well, probably partly while I've been out of the country, but even now in the winter, you go back to Adelaide or Melbourne, and it's just so firm and such a pure surface still, isn't it? I mean, I think they used to really struggle
It
through the
is.
winter with the dormancy and getting a bit leggy and losing growth and that sort of thing. I imagine if you can replicate that on some of the courses in the States, that would be very, very useful, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And I know a lot of people that have seen it have been, they're instantly drawn towards the idea of the putting surface to the edge of the bunker, because that's kind of, for most Americans, it kind of blows their mind. Because they're just not used to it. They're used to bunkers being 10 feet from the edge of a green, and there being about three different rough heights in between. And so you sort of introduce them to this concept, and it's like, oh my gosh, and I think so, yeah. So we've sort of opened the East Course has been opened for raiders just now, actually, September, October this year, and then the West Course next year. So it'll be really interesting to see what people think. So
And it's a sandbelt style course, a little bit more width. Is that set up in that way? So trying
yeah,
to
there's not
replicate some
really
of that
any.
strategy and but through width.
Yeah, it's probably six. The fairways are at least 60 yards wide. Some of them are 70 or 80 yards wide. It's a big scale course. There's not really much rough. So it pretty much goes from fairway grass to, there's a couple of spots where there's a little bit of cut rough, but it basically just bleeds out into sand and the heathland, or that sort of heathland plants and grasses. So there's about 75 acres of maintained turf on the West Course, and that or maintained like fairways, tees, green surrounds. Whereas the East Course, is more like 50 acres of fairway and 20 acres of rough. There's more sort of cut rough on the East Course, like you would see, in around London. It was tricky because you'd sort of your temptation, like we love to use short grass. Even on the East, the temptation was to run short grass, from the green through to the tee, or to use it in these different ways, and you'd constantly find yourself sort of checking yourself, going, "No, it's
It's not
not,
going to
it's not how
suit the
it will be done." No, so we had to show a bit of restraint there. Yeah,
And I guess it's replacing heather with something as well, isn't it? Normally on those courses there's such an expanse of heather. So what has that been effectively replaced with? Is that sort of a rough or other vegetation?
This native mix. So we worked really closely with a kind of a group of ecologists. So we ended up coming, there's actually a couple of different blends, but it is a mixture of sort of native grasses, and some wildflowers and some plants. I mean, there is some like some yucca, which is a long way from London, but it just adds
It
texture and
works,
color. And yeah, that's right. So we wanted that kind of 2 to 3 foot high, kind of textural element that we could run on ridges or behind bunkers or, in a tee carry. And it's worked really well. It's actually, the ecologists can't believe how well it's worked. We've had the problem where it's too thick, like it's grown too quick. Most native areas are a real challenge to keep the weeds out and to really promote them. It's a long-term thing. And the amazing thing with both courses, but particularly the East, it looks like it's been there 40 years. That was bare dirt 2 years ago.
Yeah,
Like it's
that's the
been incredibly
southeast of the
quick.
United States is you won't get a better place for growing grass, I don't think.
No, you can, what you kind of watch it, you can almost watch it grow. But so that's been great, because we always wanted that really old feel, that old established feel. It's that mixture of grasses has really allowed us to achieve that.
Yeah. And is there sort of a lot of mature trees still on site? So you've been able to create that feel through that as well. It's not just a big open expanse of land that's been shaped and built in the last 5 years.
No, we really took our time with the tree removal. We took a long time to the point where I think people questioned it. But we wanted to, we didn't want to clear fell the site. So we once we had the routing planned, we did a centerline clearing and then we just slowly worked our way out. And even once we got it to sort of 60 or 70 yards wide, we then, which was wide enough to build the hole, we would then come back through and take sort of sections to try and create a much more irregular line to the trees. So, you know, you're walking around, it doesn't feel at all like we've gone through and mechanically cleared the tree line. So that was a deliberate ploy. And it took quite a long time, but they're old, you know, longleaf pines. There's some beautiful trees out there. Yeah,
You must
fantastic.
have blown the superintendent's mind, but in a good way, I guess. He's got all these new styles of golf course and grass types and vegetation and what have you
Yeah.
to get his head around. But I imagine it's been a huge project and a great learning experience for him.
Yeah, and he's really embraced it. And he'd had a lot of experience working on new golf courses. He was he worked on Bayonne up in New York and sort of through construction and grow in. So I get and it is something you find a lot of superintendents we work with, if they have never worked in construction, it can be a challenge. Because they just in construction, you've got to react quickly, you've got to sort of see the big picture. Whereas a lot of golf course maintenance is more about just day to day and just kind of everything's very comfortable and just small little projects and things. Whereas you don't have that luxury, and so we were lucky that he'd experienced all of that. So he, you know, whilst there'd be times he would look at something and think, oh, I don't know how I'm going to maintain that, whatever.
Let
We,
me
you
go away
know.
and get my head around that.
Yeah, we generally speaking, yeah, we worked well together. And yeah, so he wasn't scared by any of what we created, really.
I guess those guys are probably starting to develop a bit of a niche for themselves once you've done a few of those projects that
They
people
do.
might come
Yeah.
looking a little bit.
Yeah, they tend to get they tend to get picked quickly. They'll kind of you often see the same supers bounce from they've done sort of construction grow in and then they've maintained the course for a year or two and then they're grabbed
They're off.
for someone else's next project. Yeah.
So
Yeah.
having completed the whole project now and it's all open and in play, what's the thoughts? It's a big success, and one thing I'd be keen to know is it a bit replicatable across other courses in the States, in different parts of the States as well, that maybe that challenge some of that challenge has been broken now, and then the nut cracked a little bit. Could we see a little bit more of this going forward? And by that, I don't mean just mean in the style of course, but the way a course will play and feel and that kind of thing.
Yeah, possibly. Look, it's been really well, very well received. So a lot of the comments have been lovely hearing from, and you do, it's always great when you hear, you know, a very highly regarded pro like Bob Ford or, you know, go there. And yeah, so we've had some nice stories and the ownership are really happy. It'll be interesting, not that rankings are everything, but, you know, obviously with one of the courses being ranked at the moment, I think in a few months' time, it'll be really interesting to hear what people say. But everyone that goes there just is blown away. Members, guests. It's sort of, I mean, and it's not just the golf, you know, that we're particularly proud of. The quality of the owner or the main sort of owner, I guess, is very passionate about architecture, about vertical architecture. And the architects that were involved there is a famous guy called Howard Backen out of San Francisco, I think, out of the West Coast of, and he builds these beautiful sort of, I guess, sort of like the rustic farmhouse would be the style of it, say, rustic barns and things, but very high end inside. So they have a rustic sort of feel to them, but then you go inside and these incredible view lines out of the building, and so I think people will be blown away by the quality of the architecture. I should point out another guy called Randall Hole's been the main sort of site architect, but. So, and it's not just one building, you know, there's an incredible range barn, huge building, which sits behind the range, which is the clubhouse. But then you've got these other pockets of accommodation on site. There's a series of sort of homes next to the short course where you can stay. Then there's a farm to table element of the site as well. So there's an active farm. So and that's another opportunity to stay. And then there's
Wow.
sort of an open village where you can stay. So there's all these, so it's not just about the golf. It's an incredible experience. I think that's what will blow people away. Like it'll be 3 or 4 days that you spend there, and I can't think of too many places like it. So, and that all adds to the memorability of the golf courses, really.
It's a hard place to see too much on. So I'm hoping some more footage creeps out over time and
There'll be a bit
we
more.
get
Yeah,
to
we've got a
see
little bit more
once
we're
the
hanging
Raiders
out
are
with.
in. Yeah.
Yeah, we're, there's a they kind of they said about a month ago, they said, look, we'd be happy for you guys to maybe put a few photos out. So we did that, and then a
Yeah.
couple of other people jumped on board. So yeah, it was fun though, because we've kind of held it under wraps for really 4 years now. So it was kind of nice to be
Just
able
kind of bursting to get it
to
out there, kind of thing. Okay. And right, let's turn to a very, very different part of the States now. Up in Minnesota, you've got a project that's underway up there at the moment, which looks equally exciting. In fact, I certainly suggest that people get onto the website and have a look. There's a video on there of it's a hole by hole flyover of the golf course partway through construction, which is really unique and I just found it absolutely fascinating. But we're talking about Tepetonka up in Minnesota. Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, it's an incredible site, beautiful site. We first spoke with Mark, the owner there. About the same time as we started talking with the Fourline guys, actually. It was about Christmas 21. And yeah, it's about and initially the parcel of land was about 200 acres, and then we through the routing process we convinced him to purchase another bit of land. But it's big, these incredible big scale undulations. It actually feels like, I don't know, did you ever go down to the Mornington Peninsula to like Cups Country? Like, did you ever play like the national courses or
No, I've
Andrews
been into
Beach
the national,
or?
but I haven't played there. I played Flinders, but yeah, not so much those ones, those big, more open exposed type places.
Well, it feels exactly like St Andrews Beach, which is a course that I was lucky enough to work on years ago. It was a boat course, but sort of I guess 40, 50 feet big scale dunes. Perfectly spaced though, so you can play holes between the dunes, and they're broad enough on top where you could play holes across the dunes, or you could play from peak to peak. So you can kind of on the site, you can almost look in any direction. It's one of those classic sites where, someone will say, oh, I can see, golf holes everywhere. Well, you sort of can, like in any direction, there's a golf hole. And then there was this huge creek, this deep ravine that kind of cuts through about a quarter of the property, which on the Mark took some drone footage while we were trapped in Australia, and that kind of really piqued our interest. We saw this incredible canyon and creek below and thought, wow, this is an amazing feature. And in the, we came up with a number of different routings, and we spent a week there trying to figure them out. None of them worked. We all just kept coming into a roadblock. And then on the last day, both Ashley and I kind of went to bed thinking, oh, bugger it, we need to scrap that and start again. We both had the same thought. Both woke up in the morning. He did a routing, I did a routing, and then we kind of mashed them together, and it worked out really well. And it's like to this day, I think it's one of our best routings. We ended up using that creek, probably half the holes, either kind of play next to it or over it or get a view of it. So we thought it was only going to kind of come into play, on 3 or 4 holes, but it's almost half the golf course. And it's just got this lovely sort of flow to it where you start by the creek and you go out into the prairie and you come back to the creek and back out in the prairie. And so it's got this really nice sort of flow to the routing. It's really sporty. It's not super long. It's probably 6,800 yards or so. It's just going to be a fun golf course, but yeah, v visually pretty impressive. We've finished shaping now, and we've just basically 80% built the short course. It's like a little sort of 8 or 9 hole short course near the clubhouse. But yeah, the main 18 are all done, and we're just hopefully everything's grassed out by the end of this month. So it
And then
should
I'll
be yeah
go to bed
previewed.
for the Minnesota winter and wake up again in the spring,
The winters are brutal up
Yeah, we
there. I
talk
couldn't.
about
I'm
growing
not sure
grass
I
in
could do
Georgia. It couldn't be any
it.
different up there, could it?
That's another world up there. But anyway, but yeah, lovely people, cool project.
What about the soils there? Is that quite sandy? Did you
It's
generally utilize what
not
was there?
we. So it's all glacial. The formations on the property are glacial formed. So, but we naively assumed it must be sand because it looked exactly like Cups Country. So we kind of got a shock when it was like, oh, it's like black topsoil. But they that it's it was very good farmland prior to the golf course. So it's a good topsoil. But in the end, we've sort of sand capped the fairways just to ensure that it plays. We want it to play kind of linksy. So there's, quite a bit of fescue and along with some bent grass in the fairway mix, all the roughs are fescue. And we want the ball to behave, when it lands short of the green, we want it to behave as though it's landing on the green. So you can really start to, it's typically windy out there, so no reason why it shouldn't play linksy.
And there's quite a bit of movement to the land as well, isn't there? A bit of
There's a lot of
elevation
movement.
change, yeah.
Oh yeah. Yep. Yeah, there's a lot. And probably you wouldn't have drone footage, when it's a bit too
Yeah,
elevated,
you
you
don't
never
really see it,
appreciate
do
it.
you?
No. No, there's a lot of movement there. I think I'm excited once, I don't know whether we'll get too many photos this year, but come spring, once there's grass down on everything and you start to get the shadow effects, I think it'll really pop. I think it's gonna be, yeah, it's gonna be a very, very good golf course, so it'll be interesting again to see what people think next
I
year.
think one of the things that looked great was the way you, I think you literally start in sort of a wooded area, don't you? And it sort of
Yeah.
opens out into this big open expanse of land. It's a bit, almost a bit reminiscent of when you play that first at Walton Heath, isn't it? And then you cross the road and then boom, in front of you, you've just got this
Yeah,
big
I can see
open
that.
piece of land. Maybe not quite so much movement on Walton Heath, but
Yeah.
yeah, that looks really interesting. But then you come back into that space later on, don't you?
You do, and that's what I meant when I was sort of talking about sort of starting near the creek. You do you go out into the prairie and then you come back, the second green's by the woods again, and then you sort of dive down into it for the third and the fourth, and then you're back out in the prairie, and then you're constantly going away from or back to that sort of wooded section with the creek below. Yeah, it's a nice feature.
It's really cool. So that'll be open when, like, sort of late 26 or late summer 26 or
I mean, it all depends on the spring and the autumn, really. If they get a nice sort of Indian summer and it gets some warmth through into September and October, bit of extra grass growth, and then a nice spring next year, then yeah, I mean, I would have thought they'll be playing golf out there in summer next year. It's just hard to know whether it'll be all 18 or what sort of whether it'll be all in perfect condition or whether it's more sort of preview rounds. But yeah, you'll see some photos and some golf out there next year.
I'll definitely leave something in the notes because this video really is worth watching. It's not very often you
Yeah.
see a hole by hole flyover of a I mean, some of the holes hadn't even been shaped, had they? I don't think at
No,
the
no,
time. So
no, that's
it's
right. Yeah.
there's just a flag stuck in the earth. But yeah, really, really good, really good. Just one last one I want to talk about, Mike, is Sandy Links, which a place that you
Yeah.
obviously know very well. Quite a unique little place in amongst some absolute gems down there. It's just across the road from Victoria, right next to Royal Melbourne. You
Yep.
had a big hand in that, obviously. But try and just for those out there who might not be familiar, it's the old Sandringham public golf course or municipal golf course that's been turned into this fantastic facility, not just for playing golf, but it's the home of Golf Australia. Is
Golf
that
Australia and the Australian PGA.
and the
So,
PGA.
yeah.
So tell us a
So
little bit about Sandy Links.
it had been talked about for a while, this idea of having a, and it was when Daniel Andrews was the Premier, who was a very keen golfer, still is a very keen golfer. And this idea of a sort of a home of golf, trying to bring everyone under the same roof, I guess. And Sandringham stood out as a potential site because it's, well, doesn't get more, geographically, where else would you put the home of golf other than right in the middle of the Sandbelt? And so it was sort of a combination of Royal Melbourne had the lease on Sandringham. They had that lease for a while because strategically it was a perfect car park during tournaments at Royal Melbourne, and they could use the, I think it was the first and the 18th as a driving range. So So it ended up being this sort of collaboration between them and the government and Golf Australia and the Australian PGA, and with the golf course, we looked at a few different options actually, because part of them taking over the site, they needed they wanted to have their elite golfers homed there. So they needed practice facilities, they needed a driving range. There wasn't really much of a driving range there prior. So in order to build a full length, or actually a double-ended driving range, we had to take two holes of the golf course out, which was a big chunk of land. So suddenly it was like, well, what do you do? It was a pretty tight packed property. So what do you do with the rest of it? And we threw up some ideas of like, you could have a 12-hole course and a short course, and you could sort of have maybe this pathway program where kids could learn the game on the short course and advance to the 12-hole course and kind of work their way up. But in the end, there were just so many different user groups, and they all want 18 holes. So in order to do that, we had to chop a couple of the longer holes up. So we ended up getting rid of all the par fives. But then the idea of sort of talking through it with them, and the Sandbelt's so well known for its par threes and its short par fours. We thought, why can't this be a Sandbelt experience for the public? It's not, despite the fact they're not as private as some of the American courses, it's still pretty hard to get on Royal Melbourne or Victoria.
More and more so as time goes
Yeah,
on
if
as
you're
well.
just a member of the public, unless you know someone or whatever. We thought, well, why don't we just build a great set of par threes and great short par fours? Everything that Sandbelt stands for: width, space, interesting greens, good looking bunkers. And then I'd been discussing it with Richard Forsyth, who's the superintendent of Royal Melbourne, and said, well, is there a chance we could use the same grass as Royal Melbourne on the greens, which is this Sutton's mix, which
That's
is this,
right.
people talk about it in hushed
It's
tones, and
mystical.
we don't know what's made up of it, and oh, I think it's two parts this. And he was, because they have the maintenance of the course, they were open to it. So we ended up agreeing on Sutton's mix for the greens. They're push-up greens, exactly like Royal Melbourne. Fescue surrounds, exactly like Royal Melbourne. And it was done on, really, it was done very cheaply. Like it was a very lean project. It was myself and one of our shapers. We had an irrigation crew, and then it was just the ground staff helping us. And that was basically it. I think we had one other person in there for 6 months, but we did sort of 9 holes 1 year, 9 holes the next. And yeah, it's been a great success. I think, initially people thought, oh, there's no par fives. But then I think I heard it a couple of times when it first opened, and then now everyone really enjoys it. You get elite golfers playing there who it's actually quite hard to score around just because of the par threes and short fours. I saw someone, Connor McDade, who's a good young player, I think shot 3 under or something the other day, or 4 under. The next best score was 1 under. That's a pretty common thing, and yet it's playable for the average golfer. There's so much space. It's great for beginners. I think it got ranked maybe 40 in the country, something like that, 40 or 45, which is like, and that, we didn't set out to try and get a ranking, but it was like at the
It's just
start of it,
more
if someone had
providing
have said
the
that.
facility that suited.
Yeah. So for $50 or $60 or $70, whatever it is, a member of the public can just ring up and go and play kind of a Sandbelt golf course. So
It's
yeah,
interesting you're talking about, scoring on a short golf course. It's one of those real myths in golf, isn't it? That, if a golf course is shorter, it's easier. It's just so not the case, especially when you take par fives out of the equation, because that's where most good golfers make their score, don't
where
they?
you make your score, like the little, we did a par three course at Kingston Heath called the Furrows, and the holes are probably 70 to 140 meters long, 9 holes. And it's actually really hard to score. Like you sort of, like, it's amazing. And you hit one loose shot, and it's like you walk off with a boat or something, and you're like, oh, you're kind of scratching your head. But there's, if the pins are tucked in the corners, there's not much room for error. And good golfers, we're not always the brightest. And so you see a pin and you've got a wedge in your hand, so you tend to go for it. You finish in the greenside bunker short sighted, and it's like, oh, that was a very smart move.
No, I just think there's such a place for maybe looking at some of these venues a bit more. One, it helps from a a land point of view, doesn't it? But you know, I think of
Yeah.
places like, I don't know whether you've ever been to Ely up in Fife.
No, I've heard a lot of things about
It's
Ely,
par
but yeah.
69. There's not a par five on the golf course, and
Yeah.
I defy anyone to go and just shoot an easy 64 around there. And you know, West
Yeah.
Hill that I mentioned earlier,
Yeah,
similar
yeah,
type
yeah.
of thing. And I, you know, was it Sedge Valley that's been built up in
Yeah.
Wisconsin at the
It's
Sand
part of Sand
Valley?
Valley. Yeah, I think it's 68 and yeah, it's not maybe 6400 or 6200.
I mean, maybe I'm biased because I never hit the golf ball far enough, so that kind of golf course suits me. But I just really think there's more of a place for building those types of facilities that are probably going to cater to, you know, the majority of golfers out there, as opposed to 7,500 yards and a slog.
Well, I think a big part of it was kind of breaking down the notion of what makes a great golf course. And, you know, I think in the 90s and 80s, there was a misconception by a lot of golfers that it had to be certain things to be a good golf course. You know, the par 72, a certain length, you know, tournament standard, all this sort of nonsense. And
Sure,
it's
return back to
taken
the
time.
clubhouse and
Yeah, but we've all sort of chipped away at it, and people have started to realize that, oh, we actually don't even need 18 holes. It doesn't need to be par 72. And I think some of the destination courses and some of the courses that the Kaisers have done are more built around fun, because as public facilities, they want return play, that people don't want to go there and get beaten up.
Yeah, if you get 200 people going around there every day, what's the point
Yeah,
in
that's
beating the
right.
hell out of everyone?
So it's, and that's slowly trickled down and filtered through even private clubs. And I think people have started to realize, actually, we are actually meant to be out here to enjoy it
Not be masochists.
and not be
No.
massive. That's right.
Anything else that's coming up imminently that you want to talk about or share? Is there any more projects that are about to happen?
Well, we've got an exciting project starting in April down this way in New Zealand, which will
Okay.
be our first project in New Zealand, where we're rebuilding the Hills course for
Ah, right. Yep. Yep.
Queenstown. Yeah.
Yep.
So I'm particularly excited about that. And then in the States, we kind of finished off some Tepe Tonka this year, and also a new project in Austin in Texas we've been working on,
Okay.
which is it's actually a very much a link style course in the middle of Texas.
Yep.
So a bit like the Heathland course in Georgia. We actually one of the shapers, Ben, was from North Berwick, and we really wanted some North Berwick vibes down there. It's a flat piece of ground, and we moved a lot of dirt, 300,000 or 400,000, oh no, 500,000 cubic meters of dirt to create a kind of a crumpled Linksland look and feel. It was kind of an out and back routing, and we were after a bit of a point of difference. So it kind of actually, believe it or not, it made some sense to go down the links path. So that'll be really interesting. We've finished shaping. It's half grassed, so we're just kind of on the finer details now. So,
Always
and
surprises
then
me there's not a bit more good golf in Texas and
it
some
is.
of
Yeah, it's
that
funny.
kind of golf that, you know, is hard and firm, and you know, it almost replicates some Aussie conditions in some ways, doesn't it? Similar
It
climate and that
does.
kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's changing now, because there have been a lot more, you know, good golf courses built in Texas. But I mean, there's almost as many courses in Texas as there are in Australia, and not a lot of very pedestrian courses. You're right. But yeah, so that's exciting. We've actually got another project in Austin, up in the hill country, which we're in design phase of. So yeah, we've got a few other pretty interesting projects over there, and some more local here.
Something I always like to ask people just before we close out, if you could pick a part of the world anywhere to go and design and build a golf course, no constraints, although you probably have had this opportunity sometimes, but
No.
where might that be, Mike, that perhaps you haven't so far, or if there's somewhere you could really say, I'd love to
Easy.
just go there and build a golf course.
The home of golf. It
Probably
has to
running out of
be.
room there now, I think.
Well, they probably are, and so it may never happen. But it'd be great to work on a project in Scotland, and I guess more broadly, you know, the UK and Ireland. But it would just be a special experience, I think. It'd be kind of a somewhat religious experience to be building a golf course in Scotland, I think would be fairly amazing.
Yeah, there'd be some eyes on it, I tell you.
It would, and that's what I mean. Look, it's probably, and I know it's so challenging developing sites over there for new golf courses, but still, that were you said I could pick anywhere, so
Exactly. No,
I'm
I
picking
said no constraints, didn't
no constraints. So there
I? Exactly.
you go.
No, I can very much understand that. And last question before we go. Who's your footy team?
It's Essendon.
Essendon. Oh, wow. Oh, bad luck.
Yeah, Bombers. Yeah, but
It's been a tough time.
I'm probably not as passionate as I once was when I
No,
was a kid.
really.
I was more into it, but these days probably less so. But
Yeah. Sorry for any non-Aussies listening out there,
yeah,
but yeah,
oh, that's
it's, we're in
okay.
finals time in the AFL at the moment. It's always an
Yeah.
exciting time around Melbourne, but my team's Geelong, so I'm
Oh,
sitting
okay.
here pretty
All right.
confident at the moment about things.
Yeah,
So,
nice.
yeah,
Yeah.
good. Mike, thank you very much
Cool.
for joining. It's been great to have a chat and
Thanks,
learn about
Leighton.
a couple of special projects and just a bit more about you and OCM. And look, I think we'll be seeing plenty more to come from the firm, and we'll keep our eyes out.
Terrific. Thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Pleasure.